Lecture 9, Avebury, Cathedral in Stone.
This lecture returns to Avebury, now that we understand the megalithic context. That great monumental complex didn't begin as a megalithic monument, but it became one, possibly as early as 3000, if you want to count it that way, and certainly by 2600, when the henge itself was built. We should pay attention, first of all, to some of the amazing statistics of this, the distinctive features of this unique complex. And those features are, for example, Silbury Hill, the henge, its stone circles, and the labor estimated as necessary to the construction of these monuments. We will then entertain Aubrey Burrell's theory about the purpose and manner of erection of this extraordinary complex. This explanation involves medical anthropology and botanical and zoological research, as well as the more familiar forms of archaeological data. Finally, I want to mention how, in order to set Avebury in its worldwide context, not just its megalithic context, Burrell discusses some parallel rituals and monuments from Neolithic North America, especially the mounds at Cahokia, Illinois. Well, first of all, the amazing statistics. 90% of the upright stones, some 600 menhirs originally, that the tireless antiquarian John Aubrey saw in the early 17th century have been taken down, some of them buried, or then destroyed, smashed up to serve as building material in the village of Avebury. And most of this happened in the course of the 17th and 18th centuries AD. Many of these stones, called Sarsen stones, are very large. The largest weigh as much as 70 tons. Consequently, moving them down from the Marlborough down to the east must have required a significant concentration of labor and a strong sense of collective purpose. The circular ditch and bank, which comprised the henge proper, were remarkably, indeed uniquely steep. Even today, after millennia of erosion, they are strikingly so. The ditch was 10 meters deep, approximately 33 feet. Since this ditch is all chalkland around here, it's very easy for excavators to tell the difference between the original walls, the original undisturbed walls, which were then cut into, and the other material that has filled up the ditch in the course of long erosions. Fortunately, lots of wonderful things like tools, antler picks and so on, which you can get carbon-14 dates from, are arranged at very convenient parts of the infill. The bank to the outside of the ditch rose 6 meters, approximately 19 or 20 feet, 6 meters high on the outer bank of the ditch. And so the original slope from the bank crest to the ditch bottom was some 16 meters or 50 feet. Remarkable when you consider that chalk, although soft, a stone is still a stone and had to be hewed out with deer antlers and with the shoulder blades of oxen, the only kind of tools they had available, nothing in metal. The distance from the crest of the bank to the cusp of the inner circle, in other words, across this great declivity, was, and since it's unaffected by erosion, still is 28 to 30 meters, depending where you're taking your measurement, or roughly 90 plus feet across from the peak of the bank to the inner side of the ditch. The area of the circle within the ditch is 11 plus hectares, or 28 and a half acres, seven times the area of Stonehenge. Seven times the area of Stonehenge. Stukeley was absolutely right when he compared Stonehenge to a mere chapel by comparison with Avebury itself. Stonehenge could easily be a chapel within that vast Neolithic cathedral. Now, the circles of upright Sarsen stones, the major part of the 600 which were set up in Neolithic times, are surprisingly regular as well as large. And the great professor of engineering, Alexander Thom, spent a lot of time measuring them with great precision. The circumference of the outer ring is 1,088 modern English feet, which equals exactly 400 megalithic yards, the unit of measurement that Alexander Thom derived after precise measurements of hundreds of megalithic monuments all over northwestern Europe. The two smaller inner circles within this great outer circle of stones each measure 340 feet in circumference, which equals, very neatly, 125 megalithic yards. Each of these smaller circles is equal in area to 10 times the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral in London, which is in turn one-tenth of the area of the entire cathedral. Thus, each of the smaller circles within the larger circle is equal in floor space to the area of the entire cathedral. Now, to any English person, this has to be a very eloquent coincidence. Is it merely coincidence? I think it is, but it's certainly eloquent. Silbury Hill, That astonishing monument rises 40 meters, or approximately 125 feet, from the marshes in which arises the River Kennet. Silbury Hill contains 250,000 cubic meters of chalk, skillfully arranged effects of malnutrition. The infections of teeth and jaws, I think, are particularly compelling. These people did not have white flour or sugar, of course, which are the most destructive of teeth. But even the processed flour they did have would tend to stick within the teeth, and from an early age, from childhood on, would tend to give these people serious infections, not just of the tooth, but of the jaw, acute gingivitis. And the jaw bones of the skeleton we found are particularly compelling, particularly moving to medical anthropologists. It's very clear that the people we're talking about lived with constant facial pain for almost all of their adult lives. Deep abscesses affected most of them. Spina bifida was fading out for genetic reasons. People with spina bifida often can't have children, and so those genes tended to be removed from the pool, but it was still present. We see here the effects of the Neolithic diet, which is not so benign for the people who eat it, as opposed to the much wider diet of hunter-gatherer cultures. Well, around 2850, drier weather returned, bringing with it some improvement in group health. The economy improved as well, but now on a much more pastoral base than before. Agriculture was less important, stock raising was more important. And the greater meat consumption that this suggests probably helped improve fertility. Human fertility, that is, not the fertility of the earth. Within that pastoral diet, however, much less beef was consumed than had been normal around 3700 BCE. We know this because of the animal bones found around Wayland, Smithy, Long Barrow in 3700 BCE, and then those found when it's redone with megalithic revetments in 3400 BCE. And the ratio of cattle bones to sheep and goat to pig bones is remarkably different. Much less cattle are being consumed. Now, why? This was another consequence of environmental change, but this time environmental change produced by humans rather than brought from without. A grain is necessary to supplement the long grass diets of cattle. Cattle have, first of all, require the grass to be long, and they can't reach it if it's very short. And secondly, they need grain to improve their diet. Earlier on, this was much more available than in this later period in which the soil is yielding much less in the way of agricultural products. On the deforested downs, sheep and goats kept cropping the grass close, much too close for cattle, which became a problem, as we will recall, in the American West, as sheep ranchers and cattle ranchers got bloody, got lethal and homicidal about this fundamental problem. This was too bad for the people as well as for the cattle, because beef consumption is especially good for female fertility. Beef and rabbit, by the way, contain a certain kind of iron, which has a great deal to do with female fertility. And there's a long digression available about rabbits, but I'll save that for a medieval class. The Windmill Hill people reacted culturally. The reason for that is they didn't have rabbits in England in any serious kind of way until the Norman Conquest. Hares, yes, the great native large rabbits of northern Europe. But the Mediterranean rabbit did not cross the channel until the Normans came, probably bringing them. Rather as the English brought rabbits to Australia in a later time with catastrophic consequences, as you know. Back to the third millennium BCE, the Windmill Hill people reacted culturally to these environmental changes, which is typical. You have environment either coming from outside or produced by human action upon their own environment. And what do you do about that? If you can go away, or you can, you know, that's one kind of reaction, but they decide to stay in place to defy these factors of decline by means of cultural changes. No new long barrows were built after about 3100. No doubt a sign that population expansion had ceased, and perhaps a sign of growing doubt in the ancestors' power over fertility. So we may have, from this evidence, sign of a religious or philosophical change, as well as of a demographic situation. A Causewayed camp was dug on Windmill Hill, possibly about 3,000, about a century after the Long Barrow. No new Long Barrows were being built. And no doubt that was part of an effort to emphasize common membership in a larger community, which we might as well call a people, a folk. Decisions may have been made there about collective response to these waves of decline and recovery, but recovery only partial. the decline, some recovery, decline, some recovery. Basically, everything is going down. Now, you may say, how would they have remembered this over several centuries? Here, perhaps, the long memory of the 70-year-olds. The 60-year-olds who can make it up to about 70 is important. And humans are very prone, farmers particularly, to believe in disaster. So that you can assume a kind of negative picture, a sort of non-optimistic view of fate, of destiny, of their fortune. Well, one response to this problem must have been the decision to drag down from the Marlborough Downs some of the great Sorsen stones that lay around at the surface and erect them in the megalithic fashion of other peoples with whom the Avebury folk may have had trading contacts. May have heard about the great menhirs in Brittany, for example, beginning to spread up into the British Isles on either side of the Irish Sea, which many people think now were supposed to improve fertility. Let's try that. And they decided to do it. Sorsen stones are a very interesting kind of stone. They're curiously, they're a curious kind of sandstone, metamorphic sandstone, which were laid down on the bottom of seas or of shallow sort of wetlands, kind of. And they have even today funny holes going through them, which have been explained by geologists as the remains of the roots of palm trees growing on these coastal wetlands and so on. That, of course, had been long, long before. And all around the Marlborough Downs lay these interesting sort of roughly rectangular grayish stones. Many of them have been moved since the Neolithic period, but in the Neolithic period, they must have been all over the place and must have seemed to them strange and wondrous. Someone must have decided they had something to do with fertility and said, let's bring them down into our henge. The West Kennet Long Barrow may, in fact, have been the first recipient of Sorsen stone improvement, even before the henge was made the center of this kind of activity. You may remember that the eastern end, the southeastern end of the West Kennet Long Barrow, is faced with great megaliths, which, first of all, the burial chambers are lined with stones, some very large ones, and then great megaliths are laid right in front to close the entire barrow. Now, maybe the improvement in weather, which happened just about then, with its accompanying increase in crop fertility, possibly in human fertility as well, had just occurred, and so dragging those huge stones may have seemed to work, for agricultural fertility at least. And so the idea spread. But this new ritual of stone moving required a tremendous amount of effort and must have made certain promises. And here Burl is, I think, particularly fascinating. Dragging those Sorsen stones down to the newly dug henge was a major problem. Many have wondered how they could have done it, and various teams of British archaeologists have gone out there in the summertime and tried to work with these stones. We talk about dry periods and wet periods. Actually, a dry period in Britain is only relatively dry. The grass around there is always wet. And several of these people working for the archaeologists and for the students of archaeology noticed that once you could get one of these things moving, it would slide along rather easily. You had to, because basically the movement is downhill from the downs, and then you slide them more or less level towards the henge. Once you do get the thing moving, you want to be sure you're not standing in front of it, because then it really rolls. But the thing is to get them moving, and then when they stop, to get them moving again. How do you do that? Burl has hypothesized that they used rawhide ropes. We know a lot about the properties of rawhide today. Rawhide is a funny material. It can be very tough and very durable, or just break like that. A rawhide rope can last for years, or it can go after 15 minutes of effort. You're not sure. And so they figured that what you'd need would be rawhide ropes about 60 or 65 feet long, and that you'd need an awful lot of them. You would have needed about 20 such ropes to get one of these multi-ton, these sort of 40 or 50 or sometimes even 70-ton Sorsens down from the downs to the henge. How many cows would you have had to kill? And of course you have to remember that cattle were much smaller in those days. In the 17th century CE, the size of almost all livestock was doubled by agricultural breeding experiments. So the cows of the second and the third and fourth millennium BCE were very small indeed. So Burl's team decided that you would have needed to kill about 100 cows in order to produce these many ropes. Now, this must have been an enormous sacrifice, a huge sacrifice for this larger community, but clearly a sacrifice that the people were convinced needed to be made. And I think we can kind of imagine the scene. It's summertime. Planting has been done. There's really not much to do until harvesting time. You don't go out and weed the crops. Modern agricultural experimentation has shown that if you plant the same grains that they used, which are practically identical with the types of wheat and barley and to a certain extent oats developed in West Asia, in fact, to get seeds of the type that would replicate the same plants that they find in pollen analyses, they had to send to Iraq and to Turkey to get those seeds, emmer wheat, einkorn wheat, and so on. We only need to weed wheat fields if we're using hybridized wheat, which grows much taller, has more space between the individual stalks, which is a desirable thing. On the other hand, in order to do that, we have to use herbicides and pesticides and all the rest of it. And it was very interesting to see the experiments in which they grew some of this old wheat and some of the new modern wheat. And without the herbicides and the pesticides, the modern wheat was pitiful-looking stuff, barely making it. But the old wheat was thick and solid and dense. You didn't have to worry about weeding out the patches. You had nothing to do, really, between planting and harvesting. And this is a productive kind of moment. Clergymen have always been worried about idleness. Idleness is the devil's workshop, modern ministers and priests have tended to say. And perhaps the priests, if they had them, or shamans, or whatever you want to call them, of the Avery region had the same thought. So they put the people to work. And I think we can imagine the entire communities out there, not just entire Long Barrow communities, but a high percentage of the population of this entire Causeway Camp-centered folk, this Causeway Camp-centered people. The young men are pulling and pushing and showing their muscle. The women and the children and some of the old folk, no doubt, are standing around enjoying the whole scene. The old folk are no doubt complaining about their jaws and their joints and all the rest of it. The children are doing what children can do quite freely. Now they don't have to work. It's a wonderful reversion to the happy time of hunting-gathering society, which we in our culture have maintained in summer break that some educators are now trying to get rid of. Eventually, the people would eat all of the meat that came from the 100 cows which had been slaughtered. So you would have had a huge sort of many week long, maybe 6 week long barbecue, a public potlatch event. And must have been a very festive occasion. And one can imagine, even in the short nights of that latitude in the summertime, a certain amount of conjugal intimacy. The result, 8 or 9 months after the erection of one of these tall stones, in late winter or early spring, the women of the community may have given birth to many more healthy children with good survival chances than had been the case for a long time. It worked. We don't have to be too Freudian, I think, to see how these menhirs may have been associated in the minds of the people with male fertility. And look, it worked. Well, you try it again, same results. You try it again, same results. After 5 or 6 tries, you have a scientific principle. You have a hypothesis, you have testing, and you have demonstration. And so we now knew that a form of what I'm afraid we have to call science arose around the place we now call Avery. So one of the reasons for setting up these extraordinary Neolithic monuments may have been, I think there's very good reason to think it probably was, scientific certitude. This was a scientific engineering project in their minds, in their culture. The people kept it up for how long? Maybe 4 to 6 centuries. Maybe that was required to erect the 600-plus stones, which were counted by John Aubrey in the 17th century and William Stukeley in the 18th. Of course, by then, by William Stukeley's counting, many of them had been destroyed, but it was clear to him how many there had been. And he got hold of Aubrey's drawings and protested violently against this desecration of these stones. Why were these stones destroyed? Well, partly because of the same sense that they had to do with successful human sexuality. And we know that several of the pastors of St. James Church in Avery were not simply Church of England ministers, they were very puritanical Church of England ministers, tended to be trained at Cambridge rather than Oxford. And we can see that they thought it was very valuable in the summertime to organize the young people not in doing potentially lustful things like moving stones, but in smashing those stones. So what they would do of a Sunday was to, and indeed many other days of the week, because we're still living in a kind of late Neolithic agricultural calendar in the 17th century CE, get the people out there on a Sunday and on other days of the summer weeks to build fires beneath the stones. And then when the fire has reached a good heat, you bring cold water in buckets, you throw it on the stones, they crack. This is a much more effective way of dealing with them than using crowbars, though there's also signs of metal implement work upon the stones as well. Why did the Neolithic people finally stop erecting these 600-plus menhirs? Perhaps general depletion finally wore them down, since the basic causes were unrecognized and had not been attended to. Perhaps the arrival of a new people, the Beaker people, bringing new technologies and new lifestyles, made this old effort seem hopelessly obsolete, embarrassing, something to drop. A change in style may have made them drop what must have been the scientific project of raising these stones in an earlier time. Now, we don't know how the Beaker people came in, as I mentioned already, as conquerors or as traders. But if they came in as conquerors, rather than as metallurgically skilled merchants, they may well have overthrown the structures of chieftainship and priesthood and so on that had organized and theorized the moving and raising of the stones. We'll probably never know, but how exciting it is to speculate. Now, to set the accomplishment of Avebury in context, not just European context, as we have to do to talk about megalithic work, but really in worldwide context, Burl suggests all kinds of rituals and sites throughout Asia, Africa, and the Americas. And he is particularly interested in Neolithic North America, which is very appropriate in a number of ways. We know that the book illustrators of 17th century England had decided that the Indians of Virginia, of whom reports were coming back to them, must have been just like the ancient British of Stonehenge and of Avebury, though they paid very little attention to Avebury. And several frontispieces, several book plates of 17th century books about the ancient British, or 18th century books more than 17th, will show the ancient British dressed just as the Indians, especially of Virginia, were dressed, because the best reports of Indians came back from Virginia rather than from New England. The Powhatan Indians of the Virginia coast, the people of Pocahontas, whom John Smith and Rolfe and so on met, had practices very like those that Burl surmises for his Windmill Hill people. First of all, they practiced excarnation in great mortuary houses, and exactly the same burial habits that are very close to the same burial habits that was common to the early English. And it's kind of appropriate. This makes the wedding of Pocahontas and Rolfe considerably less of a cultural cultural bridging act than it would seem to 17th century Englishmen. But Burl then explores a much more sustained comparison with the Mississippi Valley cultures of Neolithic North America. Here he's talking not just about burial habits, but also about housing types and about pottery types as well. Surprising that pottery, which is always so diverse, should provide bases for comparison as well as for distinction. But it does. When you talk about 3rd millennium and 4th millennium BCE, British Neolithic people and the Neolithic people of the North American Mississippi Valley. There are several cultures there, of course. The Adena culture, localized in southern Ohio, Kentucky, and so on. The Hopewell culture further west are interesting to look at. We should remember that the Adena people produced an extraordinary monument, difficult to explain, Serpent's Mound, which was seen by 19th century ministers with a sort of British Israelite belief as a clear sign that the Garden of Eden had lain along the Ohio, and that as the sacred history of the Bible had transpired in North America rather than in the Near East. Clearly, the people of Israel had moved to the land of Israel at some point, a transatlantic voyage, a very striking one indeed. That seems to us very silly, but not so silly is the fact that it's extremely difficult to figure out how the Adena people actually erected this curving mound, which looks so very much like a snake. Since they did not have ladders, and since it's at the top of a hill, where could they have gotten the sight lines to do this? This, of course, has excited the enthusiasm of people like von Daniken, the UFO people. That solves the question very easily. But if you don't believe one of these other things, then you have to recognize the genius of the engineering genius, the coordinated planning involved to create that. But more important even than Serpent's Mound in Ohio for Aubrey Burl is the great mound building complex at Cahokia in Illinois, just east of St. Louis, which is a whole series of mounds on top of which temples arose. Some of them involve burial, some of them don't. And they're lined up in kind of an avenue, very much in the pattern of the great Neolithic monument, series of monuments at Teotihuacan in Mexico. Perhaps Teotihuacan influence is coming up that way. Perhaps you don't need this influence. Aubrey Burl ends his provocative and remarkable book called Prehistoric Avebury, published in 1979, with this remarkable comparison, which suggests to us, I think, much about the common humanity that we share with these distant people.
Lecture 10, Stonehenge, Part 1.
Now let's talk about Stonehenge, the Beaker people, and the so-called Bronze Age. This lecture tracks the first two stages of the development and adaptation of the world's most sophisticated and best-known megalithic monument, Stonehenge, from the first indication of the site's importance in the 4th millennium BCE to the 22nd century thereof. After a survey of the range of speculations about the purpose and original significance of Stonehenge, this lecture presents the several diverse elements of this unique assemblage, discussing current theories of construction methods and dating. Then comes a discussion of the arrival of a new people, the Beaker people, who imported quite a different culture, involving beer and round barrows and horsemanship and bronze casting, as well as their distinctive personal beakers, which have given their culture its name. To them belongs credit for the construction of Stonehenge II, a product of the 22nd century BCE. Stonehenge is perhaps the world's best-known megalithic monument, and for good reason. Begun about the time that Silbury Hill was being constructed up at Avebury, it was redesigned and reworked for over two millennia, and finally completed from the point of view of its last builders 9 centuries or so after work had stopped at Avebury, by which time Avebury seems to have been effectively abandoned or at least ignored. But Stonehenge seems to have been a place of worship and perhaps of cosmic scientific speculation for well over yet another millennium, thanks to the Iron Age priesthood of the Druids, until the Roman conquerors of Britain put an end to that religious order. No European Neolithic or Bronze Age monument has approached the fame of Stonehenge. It was referred to by a Greek geographer of the 3rd century BCE as the temple built to the god Apollo by the Hyperboreans, the people who lived beyond the north wind, behind the north wind. Geoffrey of Monmouth, writing his History of the Kings of Britain in Oxford between 1136 and 1138, asserted that Merlin had erected Stonehenge as a monument to King Arthur's fallen heroes. It's a monument to the heroic British war dead fighting against the Saxons. And he had arranged to steal its standing stones from Ireland by magic, not by force, from Ireland, where those stones were called the Dance of the Giants. So the Dance of the Giants took to the air and flew over to Britain thanks to Merlin's remarkable magical arrangements. William Stukeley, born in 1687, dying in 1765, the eccentric but widely read English doctor, medical doctor, and antiquarian, who developed a wild theory of the Druidic religion, even though he was an ordained Anglican clergyman, rhapsodized about the meaning of Stonehenge. For him, it was the supreme Druidic temple. And he made it famous after centuries of local attention, sporadic local attention, which was, however, fundamentally neglectful. Stonehenge was auctioned off in 1915 as a piece of private real estate, as it had been for quite a while, but then the new purchaser gave it to the government, and the Department of the Environment is slowly improving the site. In 1781, shortly after Stukeley's death, Henry Hurrell founded the Ancient Order of Druids, which is still in existence today. Equipped with a Hindu-inspired ritual, since, of course, the Druids learned everything by memory and didn't want to commit any of their lore to writing, this order has attracted even such practical people as Winston Churchill, who was a member. Stonehenge is, of course, the prime temple of the Ancient Order of Druids. William Blake, born in 1757, dying 70 years later in 1827, developed Stukeley's vision further in his rambling prophetic work, Jerusalem. I don't know what to call it except prophetic. It's poetry, it's prose, it's an extraordinary work, and let's just call it a prophetic work and leave it at that. Published in 1818, he declared that Stonehenge became for Britain, or for Albion, as he preferred to call it, the successor to the Temple of Solomon, as the Druidic religion, which was a religion of law and science, replaced the poetic inspiration of the primitive Hebrew faith. Now, that primitive Hebrew faith, according to Blake, had actually arisen in Britain, not in the Near East. And if we're somewhat amused at those early 19th century Protestant ministers who decided that Serpent Mound is the site of the Garden of Eden, that the events of sacred history had transpired in North America, we should recognize at least that this line of thought, known as British Israelitism, or the theory of British Israel, has a long and distinguished history in Britain, promoted by no less a figure than William Blake. Thomas Hardy, who was born before Blake died in 1840, or after Blake died, Hardy was born in 1840 and died at the age of 88 in the year before the Great Depression in 1928, Hardy gave Stonehenge a yet wider audience when he made it the site of Tess's final surrender to the capricious immortals in his most widely read novel, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, which was published in 1891. Now, in the 20th century, a much more serious kind of speculation about Stonehenge got underway. Now, most importantly, an astronomical purpose was assigned to it. In 1956, an important date for the study of Stonehenge, Gerald Hawkins, a British professor of astronomy at Boston University in America, published Stonehenge Decoded, a book published and republished in many revised versions, in which Hawkins claimed that Stonehenge was constructed as an observatory to observe, record, and predict many diverse movements of the sun, moon, and even some navigational stars. Hawkins' claim was strongly resisted by professional archaeologists such as the great R.J.C. Atkinson, who long directed the excavations of the site. However, in the last revised version of his basic book for a popular audience, simply entitled Stonehenge and published by Penguin, Atkinson came around to a very modified version of Hawkins' thesis. Aubrey Burrell, the brilliant, imaginative interpreter of Avebury, went to work on Stonehenge, too, after he had published his work, Prehistoric Avebury. In 1987, he published a book called The Stonehenge People, and in it, he accepts the notion that Stonehenge had, from the beginning, some astronomical significance, but he insists that its primary function had to do with death and burial. It is for him a grim monument rather than an enlightened temple to Neolithic science or Bronze Age science. In the early 20th century, Sir Arthur Evans, the great Oxford archaeologist who dug up the Palace of Knossos at Crete, made such an impact upon Mediterranean archaeology, had decided that Stonehenge was absolutely that it was a funereal monument which was supposed to suggest strong connections to the netherworld. Burrell follows out Evans' theory, developing it this sort of a remark of Evans. Burrell makes an entire and really deeply, deeply reasoned book out of it. According to Burrell, Hardy got it right when he had Tess surrender there to unmasterable forces, which were really forces of evil, or at least forces of depression. Well, Stonehenge's construction has been described in terms of three, or really actually of five different phases, which are conventionally described as Stonehenge 1, 2, 3A, 3B, and 3C. Now, some people disagree about what actually happened in 1 as opposed to 2, but fundamentally, all the people have held to these basic labels. Stonehenge 1 is the first stage of this unique monument, built by the Windmill Hill culture in the territory to the south of the Windmill Hill territory where the vast ritual complex of Avebury had arisen. This is the territory that Paul Ashby calls the Robin Hood's Ball territory, but the one which had 111 long barrows constituting that important people. Stonehenge 1 consists of eight elements of interestingly different character. Nothing as grand and extraordinary as the diversity of Avebury, but in many ways far more interesting on a much smaller and more refined scale. The henge proper, the circular ditch and bank here, the bank is inside the ditch, unlike Avebury. The ditch and bank are exceptionally shallow, nor is the circle particularly large. Its diameter from outer edge to outer edge of the ditch is less than 350 feet. Stonehenge 1 was clearly not designed to impress. By the time it was laid out, Neolithic Britons knew what a henge meant, if only we did. Element number 2 is the heel stone. It got its name from John Aubrey in 1666. He thought the uneven surface of that Sarsen stone resembled a large foot, of which the heel was clearly marked, and the name has stuck. This stone is located 65 feet beyond the outer ditch to the northeast, where the ditch and bank are broken, indicating a direction of orientation. The henge of Stonehenge is oriented to the northeast, and more specifically to the place where the sun rises at midsummer in that latitude. In 1980, the archaeologist Michael Pitts identified a rectangular depression in the undisturbed chalk as the former site of the heel stone's twin, which would seem to have been about the same size. These were large Sarsen stones, weighing between 40 and 60 tons, dragged down from the Marlborough Downs 18 miles to the north, not just 18 miles away, twice, The draggers of these stones would have had to go down into river valleys. That would have been convenient. But then they would have had to drag the things up from the other side of the river valley, which would have been inconvenient indeed. How many rawhide ropes would they have needed to do that? Hard to estimate. A line drawn between the heel stone and its vanished twin, between the heel stone and the vanished twin from the center of the hinge, which is called the axis of symmetry on most current plans of Stonehenge, and I'll call it that for simplicity's sake. That line points to the spot on the horizon where the sun rises at midsummer, which, as you know, is normally the 21st of June, though the date can vary as widely as all the way from the 19th of June to the 23rd. A low embankment surrounds the heel stone, but curiously enough, not its twin, unless the embankment was put up later after the twin had been torn down, had been taken down. The sites of two smaller stones have been found along the axis of symmetry, the line leading to the center of the hinge, and they were placed at uneven distances, but roughly equal distances, between the heel stone twin axis and the flat northeastern opening of the hinge. At the place where the hinge bank stops to leave a flat approach to the northeast, there was a fourth element of Stonehenge, another large Sorsen stone which has long been lying flat and which now has been called the Slaughter Stone for several centuries. It has that lurid name because early modern visitors imagined human sacrifices and other demonic activities taking place there. It was almost certainly set upright and later fell down or was pulled down, as likely happened to the heel stone's twin. It's located just to the right of the axis of symmetry. It also seems to have had a twin broken up and carried away. All this has led some to speculate that the original planners of Stonehenge I envisioned four upright Sorsen stones marking the summer sunrise axis. Item element number five, post holes. Several post holes, three dozen or more, have been found in the chalk at the northeast entry to the henge, and another six just behind the heel stone. This has led archaeologists to conclude that the planners of Stonehenge I set up wooden posts there for moon sightings. That is, the rising and the setting of the moon at different times of the year. This is very complicated. I won't try to get into it. But John Aubrey, for example, asserts very clearly that Stonehenge I was much more concerned with the moon than with the sun. With Stonehenge II came the orientation to solar activity. Element number six. 56 holes, now called Aubrey holes, in honor of John Aubrey, the 17th century antiquarian who gave the heel stone its name and to whom we owe the first reliable description of Stonehenge and of Avebury. These 56 holes were dug at regular intervals just inside the low embankment of the henge. Wooden posts were originally placed in them, and pottery and bones were deposited later in some of them. They may relate, these Aubrey holes, to the 55-plus year cycle of the moon's setting and rising positions from that vantage point. Hawkins went so far as to argue that the function of the Aubrey holes and their posts was to predict lunar eclipses. Very few people have followed him in that speculation. Element number seven. Four station stones were set up in a rectangular quadrilateral just within the embankment, either toward the end of the Stonehenge I project or perhaps even later in Stonehenge II or III. Three of these stones are visible today. Two of them, at the southeast and northwest corners of their rectangle, are surrounded by low embankments which overlap the henge's main bank, and this has led several archaeologists to conclude that they were rebuilt as late as Stonehenge 3, 3A or 3B, something. The four sides of that rectangle mark out the zones within which midsummer sunrise and midwinter sunset must occur at that latitude, and within which the moon must rise and set. One of the most striking features of this rectangle is that it only works at that latitude. 10 or a dozen miles further north or south, any such quadrilateral could not be rectangular. Its angles would not be 90-degree angles. Now, this raises the question. Did Neolithic astronomers notice that after Stonehenge I was built and then set up the station stones? Or did some of them know this even before and thus choose this as the place at which to set up this extraordinary temple to the moon and sun, if that indeed is what they thought they were doing? The eighth, and in some ways the strangest element of Stonehenge I, is a curious feature which Stukeley called the cursus. It's about a third of a mile away to the north. And Stukeley called it the Courses because he was sure it must have been the site of a racetrack. Foot races, probably, although he was thinking of druids with horses, as a matter of fact. But we know that it was set up before horses were at all common in Britain. Domesticated horses may not have existed at all at that time. The Courses consists of parallel embankments closed at either end, like a very long attenuated sausage, if you want. It runs almost exactly east-west, actually just slightly south of west to north of east, for nearly 2 miles. At its eastern end is a long barrow oriented due south. Neolithic Britons erected a few other courses, the purpose of which still remain entirely mysterious. There's a much smaller one, a little unfinished one, about a quarter of a mile to the northwest of the Great Stonehenge courses. 3/4 mile to the east of the Great Courses, in line with its axis, is a small henge now called Woodhenge, overlooking the River Avon. Its low bank enclosed an oval wooden house, constructed of large and small posts, almost certainly roofed with wheat thatch, and almost certainly a mortuary house, a charnel house for excarnation. Just to the north of Woodhenge, immediately to the north of it, was a large henge several times the size of Stonehenge, now called Durrington Walls, also with its roundhouse of logs and thatch, almost certainly, once again, a mortuary house situated pretty close to the center of that henge. So some think, Earl certainly likes the idea, that these things began as funerary monuments, these henges did, and then got turned into a kind of astronomical direction. Or he admits there may have been an initial astronomical interest, which then involved the construction of a mortuary house. Burl is convinced that there was such a mortuary house, but interestingly enough, a rectangular one, not a circular one, inside Stonehenge 1. So, Stonehenge was situated in a cluster of pre-existing Neolithic monuments. Perhaps the Courses is even earlier than the henge. Burl is inclined to date it as early as 3500, so it really predates Stonehenge 1, which he thinks was laid out fundamentally starting around 2750 BCE, about the time that Silbury Hill was being constructed at Avebury, 18 or 20 miles to the northwest. R.J.C. Atkinson originally estimated the dates of Stonehenge 1 as 2350 to 1900 BCE, but revised that estimate backward to about 2800 BCE. Now, this is a sign of a general movement. Carbon-14 dating has moved back most Neolithic monuments' dates. In fact, under the present car park at Stonehenge have been found 3 post holes dug for very large tree trunks. It would be difficult to put the arms of a middle-sized man around them. And these tree trunks have been dated by calibrated carbon-14 calculations as far back as the 4th millennium BCE, perhaps even predating the Courses. So this has been thought some kind of very special site for a very long time. You can't tell from 3 post holes exactly if they're oriented at anything or what they could possibly have been for. One thinks of totem poles of the Northwest Native Americans. Some centuries after Stonehenge 1 was complete, a new people arrived in Britain. We call them the Beaker people because of the distinctive pots with which they like to be buried. The signs of this new people's culture are unmistakable. The round barrows in which many of their skeleta have been found always contain 1 ceramic beaker per person. If a man and woman are buried together, 2 beakers, usually 1 larger for the man and 1 smaller for the woman, are usually found next to their bones. Now, of course, a lot of these beakers were opened up by amateur ladies and gentlemen in the 18th and 19th century, and the beakers were, and other objects like flints and so on were removed to somebody's country house, and most of the bones were simply thrown away or reburied or something of that sort. So we can't be as certain as we would like to be. There are, fortunately, a fair number of beakers which have been explored scientifically, and some of these antiquarians kept pretty good records, and there are a few which have not been opened yet, which archaeologists are saving for the future with what I think is great generosity. In the properly identified beakers, if a baby's skeleton is present, then he or she usually has a baby beaker along as well. These beakers are easily classified in a sequence of closely related styles, clearly related to the bell beakers of megalithic Spain and megalithic Central Europe. And the beaker people were often buried with bronze jewelry and or weapons. They seem to have been bronze smiths, bringing to the British Isles a metal technology which had been developed in the Near East in Mesopotamia in the 4th millennium. And so they come in nearly 2,000 years later, really about 1,500 years later with this new technology. The Beaker people seem to have brought along also the brewing of beer, made mostly from barley, which they appear to have imbibed from their beakers. Were these beakers therefore a sign of individual character? Everybody has to have a beaker, an individual character which could be heightened to an alcoholic euphoria from time to time, a habit unfortunately long deeply ingrained in Western culture and in some other cultures as well. The beaker people also brought horses, which either rode or had pulling their wagons, or both. Their wagons may well have carried the bronze maker's equipment and materials. They found very good bronze making materials in Britain, of course. The tin of Cornwall was tremendously convenient. It was, in fact, exported all the way to the Eastern Mediterranean. The beaker people may have come to Britain to get closer to the tin supply, some speculate, rather than to find new lands to conquer. These people were physically quite distinct from the native Neolithic British. They were somewhat taller. They were brachycephalic or round-headed, and they tended to mate with their own physical type. They were, to use that simple categorization of European races as Mediterranean, Nordic, and Alpine, they were Alpines. Now one has to ask, whence, when, and how did the beaker people arrive in Britain? One of the earliest known beakers, found at the eastern end of the West County Long Barrow at Avebury, perhaps with the last burial there, seems to date, again by carbon 14 dating, from about 2250 BCE. So the 23rd century seems a good guess at the general date of this new people's arrival. They clearly came from the continent, but whether ultimately from Spain or from Central Europe is, as you can imagine, hotly debated. Did the beaker people come as conquerors? Gordon Child and practically everyone else who speculated about